who are joining us now will be able to join the service at that time. This morning we're continuing in 1 Samuel, looking at the life of David. And this is one of my favorite chapters. This particular lesson is one of my favorite lessons in the life of David. And it's not just because this is the chapter, 1 Samuel's chapter 17. It's not because this is the chapter where David defeats Goliath. And maybe when I was a youngster, that was one of my favorite stories in the Bible. But that's really not why it's a favorite chapter of mine. And we'll get into that here in a moment. But let's go ahead and begin reading. And 1 Samuel 17 and verse 1. Now the Philistines gathered together the armies to battle and were gathered together at Shokah, which belongeth to Judah, and pitched between Shokah and Azekah in Ephesdamim. And Saul and the men of Israel were gathered together and pitched by the valley of Elah and set the battle in array against the Philistines. And the Philistines stood on a mountain on the one side, and Israel stood on a mountain on the other side, and there was a valley between them. And there went out a champion of the camp of the Philistines named Goliath of Gath, whose height was 6 cubits and a span. And he had a helmet of brass upon his head and was armed with a coat of mail. And the weight of the coat was 5,000 shekels of brass. And he had greaves of brass upon his legs and a target of brass between his shoulders. And the staff of his spear was like a weaver's beam, and his spear's head weighed 600 shekels of iron. And one bearing a shield went before him. And he stood and cried unto the armies of Israel and said unto them, Why are you come out to set your battle in array? Am not I a Philistine, and you servants of Saul? Choose you a man for you, and let him come down to me. If ye be able to fight with me and to kill me, then will we be your servants. But if I prevail against him and kill him, then shall you be our servants and serve us. And the Philistine said, I defy the armies of Israel this day. Give me a man, that we may fight together. When Saul and all Israel heard those words of the Philistine, they were dismayed and greatly afraid. Now David was a son of that Ephrathite of Bethlehem, Judah, whose name was Jesse, and he had 8 sons, and the man went among men for an old man in the days of Saul. And the 3 eldest sons of Jesse went and followed Saul to the battle, and the name of his 3 sons that went to battle were Eliab the firstborn, and the next unto him Abinadab, and the 3rd Shammah. And David was the youngest, and the 3 eldest followed Saul. But David went and returned from Saul to feed his father's sheep at Bethlehem. And the Philistine drew near morning and evening, presented himself 40 days. And Jesse said unto David his son, Take now for thy brethren an ephah of this parched corn, and these 10 loaves, and run to the camp of thy brethren. And carry these 10 cheeses unto the captain of their 1,000, and look how thy brethren fare, and take their pledge. Now Saul and they and all the men of Israel were in the valley of Elah fighting with the Philistines. And David rose up early in the morning and left the sheep with the keeper, and took and went as Jesse had commanded him. And he came to the trench as the host was going forth to the fight, and shouted for the battle. For Israel and the Philistines had put the battle in array, army against army. And David left his carriage in the hand of the keeper of the carriage, and ran into the army, and came and saluted his brethren. And as he talked with him, behold, there came the champion, the Philistine of Gath, Goliath by name, out of the armies of the Philistines, and spake according to the same words, and David heard them. And all the men of Israel, when they saw the man, fled from him, and were sore afraid. And the men of Israel said, Have you seen this man that is come up? Surely to defy Israel is he come up. And it shall be that the man who killeth him, the king will enrich him with great riches, and will give his daughter, and make his father's house free in Israel. And David spake to the men that stood by him, saying, What shall be done to the man that killeth this Philistine, and taketh away the reproach from Israel? For who is this uncircumcised Philistine, that he should defy the armies of the living God? And the people answered him after this manner, So shall it be done to the man that killeth him. And Eliab, his eldest brother, heard when he spake unto the men. And Eliab's anger was kindled against David. And he said, Why camest thou down hither? And with whom hast thou left those few sheep in the wilderness? I know thy pride and the naughtiness of thine heart, for thou art come down that thou mightest see the battle. And David said, "What have I now done? Is there not a cause?" And he returned from him toward another and spake after the same manner, and the people answered him again after the former manner. And we'll stop reading there. And so what I want to do is begin by considering who, before we look into David, consider who this Philistine is. He is called Goliath of Gath. And in this name, we see a little bit, we can get a glimpse into his ancestry. Back in Numbers 13, 32, it says, "And they brought an evil report of the land which they had searched unto the children of Israel, saying, The land through which we have gone to search it is a land that eateth up the inhabitants thereof, and all the people that we saw in it are men of great stature. And we saw the giants, the son of Anak." Now this is when Israel was in the wilderness before they went into the promised land. And the report came back, and it says, "And we saw giants, the sons of Anak, which come of the giants. And we were in our own sight as grasshoppers, and so we were in their sight." So you could see in David's time, this army was afraid of this man, Goliath. Well, this is how it was for the people when they came and reported back. They were picturing going and having to enter the promised land, and here they are as the people who have just fled Israel. I don't know how well trained in military things they were at that particular time, but they were going to be having to go into the promised land and fight a bunch of Goliaths to take over the land. And notice it says that they were the sons of Anak, which come of the giants. And though now then you go to Deuteronomy chapter 2, in verse 10, it says, "The Emims dwelt there in times past, a people of great, or a great people and many, and tall as the Anakims, which also were accounted giants as the Anakims, but the Moabites called them Emims." Now, we come to the days of Joshua. And when the people of Israel went to war with all the inhabitants of the promised land, those Anakims, so we're about 38, 40 years after the first report of the giants, and Joshua comes in, and it says they went to war with the inhabitants of the promised land, or when they did go to war, the Anakims were driven out, and they settled in three notable places, Gaza, Gath, and Ashdod, which became the land of the Philistines. And so we see in Joshua chapter 11, in verse 21, it says, "And at that time came Joshua and cut off the Anakims." So he cut off this this people of giants from the mountains, from Hebron, from Debir, and from Anab, and from all the mountains of Judah, and from all the mountains of Israel. Joshua destroyed them utterly with their cities. There was none of the Anakims left in the land of the children of Israel, but notice this, only in Gaza, in Gath, and Ashdod they remained. So this happened during the time of Joshua. And now we fast forward and we come to the time of David, and there's still giants in the land, and we see Goliath of Gath as one of these men. Well, just how big were some of these giants? You know, Goliath wasn't the only big dude left of the Anakims. He had brothers. There was others that are listed. If you go and read other accounts, there were other giants in the land. But he would not have been like some basketball player. When it gives his height, he would have been more like a defensive lineman, I believe. Although he was about 9 feet tall, he was one big dude, big boned, you might say. And the reason we know that he wasn't just some tall, skinny dude is because of his armament. And you think, well, man, you know, a guy being 9 feet tall and weighing 450, 500 pounds, he's going to be slow. You just got to be quicker than that guy. Well, you know, I remember when I was growing up in the 80s, there was a guy named Refrigerator Perry, played for the Chicago Bears. Everybody knew about Refrigerator Perry. He was called Refrigerator because he was big in a this way. He wasn't very fast, and he weighed around 300 pounds. In fact, I remember Coach Ditka told him that if he didn't get under 300 pounds, he was going to cut him from the team. Because back then, you weren't viewed as athletic, and this is only in the 80s, right? You weren't viewed as being athletic if you were 300 pounds. Well, now, you can't be an offensive lineman unless you weigh 300 pounds. And some of the defensive guys that play in the NFL weigh well over, on the line, they weigh well over 300 pounds. It's just a constant thing. And there's some very, very athletic guys. Can think of even some that have been in the NBA. They spend their career, their 20s and 30s, they're 7 foot, 7 foot four, 300 to 350 pounds, and they spend their career running up and down a basketball court and jumping and dunking and shooting three-pointers. Well, just as men are getting more athletic and larger and so forth in our day, this is the kind of person I believe that Goliath would have been. He was a very athletic, but he was very large, but that doesn't mean he was slow. He was a warrior, and people were scared to death of him. The weight of his coat of armor was approximately 150 pounds. That's why I know that he wasn't some 9 foot, 300 pound guy. That's skinny for, you know, for 9 foot tall. And because his coat, just his coat, weighed as much as Taylor. Just to put it in perspective, he went out to battle with the size of an average sized guy draped on his back. That was just his armor. I mean, think about that. How are you supposed to, the tip of his spear was 18 pounds. Is it really necessary to kill a guy, a little 5 foot 10, 185 pound soldier? Is it necessary to have an 18 pound head on your spear? But that's what he had. And it says that his the overall weight of his spear, the tip of it was 18 pounds, but the overall weight of it would have been 35 pounds, just his spear. So he was a very, very strong, I believe he would have been an agile, athletic individual. And the amazing thing is that this is not all for show. He could move and function in it. He struck fear for a legitimate reason, and he had an armor bearer who went before him with a shield. And so he was quite a weapon. In verse 11, we see the armies of Israel, as I've already related to, the armies of Israel during David's time and Saul's time. Now they had a king. In the wilderness, they had Moses. And I'm sure that a lot of people looked at Moses and said, who is Moses to lead us in military matters, right? He was out watching flocks in the backside of the wilderness, and he's not a military guy, and we're not experienced. But things were different during the days of Saul. I mean, they had been fighting. They had kicked the people out of the promised land had been fighting with the Philistines back and forth. And yet we see the armies of Israel behaving like their forefathers did 400 years ago when they reported to Moses back concerning those giants. It says they were dismayed in the wilderness. It said that of them that they were dismayed and greatly afraid. And here we have the armies of Israel dismayed and greatly afraid over one of those giants. And so it says in verse 12, now David was the son of that Ephrathite of Bethlehem, Judah, whose name was Jesse. And he had eight sons, and the men went among men for an old man in the days of Saul. And the three eldest sons of Jesse went and followed Saul to battle. And the names of his three sons that went to battle were Eliab the firstborn, the next son of him Abinadab, the third Shammah. And David was the youngest, and the three eldest followed Saul. But David went and returned from Saul to feed his father's sheep in Bethlehem. If you remember, how did our previous chapter end? Our previous chapter had ended with David had already been called up, left his father's sheep, and was in the palace, the house of Saul, as his personal musician. And Saul loved him, and he became his armor bearer. But now that they're going to war, they're going out against the Philistines, they went ahead and gave him leave, and David had gone back to keep his father's sheep. for this time frame. And so it says that he returned from Saul to feed his father's sheep. In verse 16, and the Philistines drew near morning and evening and presented him, and this Philistine presented himself 40 days. Think about that. It's been going on for a long time before David shows up. And Jesse said unto David his son, take now for thy brethren an ephah of this parched corn and these 10 loaves, and run to the camp of thy brethren, and carry these 10 cheeses and the captain of their 1,000, and look how thy brethren fare, and take their pledge. Now Saul and they and all the men of Israel were in the valley of Elah fighting with the Philistines. And David rose up early in the morning and left the sheep with the keeper, and took and went as Jesse had commanded him. And he came to the trench as the host was going forth to fight, and shouted for the battle. You know, when I have read this in the past, until I began putting these lessons together, it never really dawned on me. I don't know if I'm the only one, but I've always pictured this scene where every day the Philistines would, the two sides would come together, and Goliath would get up and do his thing, and then everyone would go back to their camp. But this had been going on 40 years, but the thing is, there was fighting that was going on a daily basis. It's just Goliath was part of the scene, but they were still getting together and they were still in battle. And it says this as David showed up. He rose up in the morning, left the sheep with the keeper, and took and went as Jesse commanded him. And he came to the trench as the host was going forth to the fight and shouted to the battle. I want to pause a little bit, though, here in the story. And if you recall last week when I was beginning this series, I asked, what's so special about David? Why is so much written about David compared to any other character in the Word of God? And one of the things that I mentioned is that David is known as being a type of Christ. And I want to pause here and take a look at how it is the things that we can see so far, just in the first two chapters, in looking at the life of David. And so, what have we seen so far? In this chapter, we see David the shepherd. And David was more than a shepherd already. By the time we get here, David was already more than just a shepherd. He was also already anointed to be king. He's keeping the sheep while he is already anointed to be king. When he was anointed, he did not stop shepherding his father's sheep. And so it was with Christ, is with Christ. He did not come the first time to promote himself as king. He is king. He is the Lord of lords and the King of kings. But he is pictured as a shepherd. The Lord, Jesus Christ, is pictured as a shepherd who gives his life for the sheep. And it's mentioned several times in this way. David was not just a shepherd as a hired servant, was he? Whose flock was David watching? He was watching his father's flock. And consider, turn to John chapter 10. In John chapter 10, we'll begin reading in verse 11. We'll come back to this chapter here in a minute. But as we're considering, David was not just a shepherd as a hired servant. I believe in this instance, he also depicts Christ as the good shepherd. And Jesus said in John chapter 10, the thief cometh not but for to steal, to kill, and to destroy. I am come that they might have life, and that they might have it more abundantly. I am the good shepherd. The good shepherd giveth his life for the sheep. But he that is an hireling, so Jesus said of himself, I am the good shepherd. The good shepherd giveth his life for the sheep. But he that is a hireling, and not the shepherd, this is why I pointed out that David was not a hireling in that sense. He was watching his father's sheep, and not the shepherd, whose own the sheep are not. The wolf seeth the wolves coming, and leaves the sheep, and fleeth. So this is what the hired hand would do. And the wolf catches them, and scattereth the sheep. The hireling fleeth because he is an hireling, and cares not for the sheep. I am the good shepherd, and I know my sheep, and have known of mine, as the Father knoweth me, even so I know the Father, and I lay down my life for the sheep. And so We know from other passages, it's referred to as those of us who are his sheep, those of us who are God's children, those of us for whom he died, were given to Christ by the Father. And compare now what Jesus just said in John to David's own testimony. We didn't read it yet, but later in 1 Samuel 17. So go back to 1 Samuel 17. And we see how exactly what kind of shepherd David was. It spoke about how a hireling sees a wolf coming. Jesus said, a hireling sees a wolf coming and he runs. A wolf. Jesus didn't say a bear or a lion. David protected his father's sheep from a bear and a lion, not just a measly little wolf, right? And so, as a young man, and so David, in 1 Samuel 17, verse 32, David said to Saul, as he's preparing to go now and fight this Philistine, and David said to Saul, let no man's heart fail because of him, because of Goliath. Thy servant will go and fight with this Philistine. And Saul said to David, thou art not able to go to battle against this Philistine to fight with him, for thou art but a youth, and he a man of war from his youth. So he's saying, you are a youth. He's been fighting. You know, sometimes when we're talking to younger people, I've been doing this since the day you were born, right? Well, he's saying, you're a youth, and this Philistine has been a man of war since his youth. He's got twice the experience you have. And David said unto Saul, thy servant kept his father's sheep, and there came a lion and a bear, and took a lamb out of the flock. Remember how Jesus had said, a man who's protecting his own sheep will go and retrieve that lamb from the wolf. And David says here, there came a lion and a bear, and took a lamb out of the flock. And I went out after him and smote him, and delivered it out of his mouth when he rose against me. I caught him by the beard and smote him and slew him. He did not just go after this bear because this bear is a problem bear and he's killing sheep. David went after the bear and rescued the lamb. The bear was still, or the lion, was still hauling the sheep away. And he actually rescued this lamb. And so it says, smote him and slew him. Thy servant slew both the lion and the bear. And this uncircumcised Philistine shall be as one of them, seeing he hath defied the armies of the living God. And so we see that the similarity there, but we also see that they are his father's sheep. Notice that they are his responsibility. And although they're his father's sheep, they were his responsibility to take care of. They would have known his voice. And he was a provider. David was the provider and protector for those sheep. But ultimately, they were his father's sheep. Here's an interesting thing. David, obviously, maybe the best shepherd in the history of Israel, in how it's been demonstrated, the risks he took to protect his father's sheep. He never got to shepherd his own sheep. He didn't have his own flock that he was actually shepherd of. He only shepherded his father's sheep. John 10:27 says this, my sheep hear my voice, and I know them, and they follow me. And I give unto them eternal life, and they shall never perish, neither shall any man pluck them out of my hand. My Father which gave them me is greater than all. See, they're his father's sheep. My Father, Jesus is saying, my Father which gave those sheep to me is greater than all, and no man is able to pluck them out of my Father's hand. I and my Father are one. David viewed those sheep as his sheep because they were his father's sheep. But they were, he was not by any means, was he a hireling. In John 6:38, it says this, I came down from heaven not to do my own will, but the will of him that sent me. This plays into the next thing that we'll look at. Keep that in mind. The will of him that sent me. And this is the Father's will which has sent me, that of all which he hath given me, I should lose nothing, but should raise it up again in the last day. And so we see that they are the Father's sheep. and Jesus was here to do the Father's will. David was just doing the Father's will in more ways than one. But here, as we conclude this portion of him as a shepherd, he defends the flock from predators. Each sheep to David, evidently, for some reason, was worth risking his life for. You're risking your life when you go after a bear as a 17-year-old kid or a lion. I personally would rather go after a bear than a lion. I don't know. Lions are quicker and they got claws that can reach out. And I don't know. Let me get a bear. But still, it's an amazing thing that David thought, evidently in his heart, it was just instinct. It was just there. They're my father's sheep. And I'm going to do what it takes to guard my father's sheep. And it was worth risking his life for, evidently. For the average shepherd, even if he owns the sheep, it's not going to... Doing hand-to-hand combat with a lion isn't going to happen. It's just not worth it. And so a rancher might get a rifle and go after a grizzly bear, but he's not going to go after it with a machete. Right? And so this is kind of like more what was going on here. And so with Christ, here's one thing, the beautiful thing. With Christ, as we already saw, no man's able to pluck him out of his father's hand. But with Christ, not one sheep is ever lost to a predator. Think about that. There are wolves that enter in. There's grievous wolves that enter in. And as pastors, even we have duty. Even the elders in Ephesus, Paul told the elders in Ephesus, plural, that it was their duty to protect the flock from the grievous wolves that will enter in. But we, when we're pastors, we can even fail, or elders, we can fail at times. But with Christ, we might fail in certain areas, but with Christ, no one individual who has ever become one of his sheep is ever eternally lost. That's an amazing thing to think about, is it not? It's not possible. And so David, as we move on, David provided caretakers to feed the flock while he was gone. And this is one of my favorite parts. David, as a shepherd, looking after his father's sheep, did not rely... This is so interesting. Why, when Jesse sent David away, why didn't David or Jesse just tell David, go do this? And then Jesse, they're his sheep. Jesse should have, this is normal actually, Jesse would just go and find some other local kid or some other guy who wasn't going to battle to take care of the sheep. But that's not what happened. If you look in verse 20, it says, and David rose up early in the morning and left the sheep with the keeper. When I think about this, I'm made to think of the directive given to Peter before Christ ascended. John 21, verse 15. So when they had dined, Jesus said unto Simon Peter, Simon, son of Jonas, lovest thou me more than these? He said unto him, yea, Lord, thou knowest that I love thee. He said, feed my lambs. He said to him again the second time, Simon, son of Jonas, lovest thou me? He said unto him, yea, Lord, thou knowest that I love thee. He saith unto him, feed my sheep. He saith unto him a third time, Simon, son of Jonas, lovest thou me? See, Jesus had been able to be, when he was here during his earthly ministry, he preached and taught and cared for his people. And now he's looking to Peter. Do you love me? Feed my sheep. Feed my sheep. Feed my lambs. And so Peter was grieved because he said unto him the third time, lovest thou me? And he said unto him, Lord, thou knowest all things. Thou knowest that I love thee. Jesus saith unto him, feed my sheep. And so I see a similarity there somewhat. I'm not trying to read in too many things, I don't think. I'm just trying to point out some things that, if nothing else, if they're not a complete type, they still cause me anyway to think about this. How that before Jesus left, he came and he did the will of the Father. And then he was going on to his next mission. And he'll be coming back as a king. And he's going, and he's the head of the church, but he can't be here to physically, in person, protect the flock. He set up people to do that for him, in pastors and elders in churches. It is absolutely mandatory that if a Christian is to live a healthy spiritual life, they have to be in a church. They have to be part of a church body in which there is a shepherd and a teacher and someone to feed the lambs and feed the sheep. And so then, of course, concerning Christ, we have the Great Commission. But consider this from Christ's perspective, as we see it in his prayer to the Father in John chapter 17. Turn to John chapter 17. We know what the Great Commission is when he gave those orders to the apostles to go into all the world and preach and teach and baptize and make disciples and so forth. But in John 17, in verse 18, this is Jesus praying to his Father, "As thou hast sent me into the world, even so have I sent them into the world, and for their sakes I sanctify myself, that they also might be sanctified through the truth. Neither pray I for these alone," and I love this part. When Jesus was praying to the Father, he wasn't just praying for those in the early church, for those with whom he had spent so many important days of his life. But he says, "Neither pray I for these alone, but for them also which shall believe on me through their word." And people have been believing every generation. It's just perpetuated. People continue to believe and receive the gospel message. And I believe he was also praying for us when he was praying in this context. And so in this chapter, we also see, of course, in back to 1 Samuel, concerning David, we see David doing the will of his father. You know, if David had not been doing the will of his father, he would have never had the encounter with Goliath. His father's will was not one-dimensional. You're a shepherd. That's what you're going to do. That's what you were born to do. You obviously have great ability and great skill at being a shepherd. There's never been and never will be another shepherd like David. I mean, you're 17, 18, 19 years old, and you are already the best shepherd that this world has ever seen. You've killed a bear and a lion with your own hands, and that's your calling. That's what you're meant to do. No, Jesse wasn't like that with his son. He wasn't selfish concerning his son. It would have been Jesse's best interest from a financial standpoint, maybe, to have Jesse look over all his flocks. But David would not have ever even ended up at the scene with Goliath if he had not just been doing what his father told him to do. His father did not tell him, "You know, I hear about this one giant named Goliath. Why don't you go and check it out?" No. David was actually sent on kind of a menial task. He's just an errand boy, just doing his father's will. And so he did not say, David, consider it from David's standpoint. This was the father's perspective, as I've mentioned. But from David's perspective, he did not say, "Do you want me to be a shepherd or do you want me to be an errand boy? You know, on one day I'm over here and I'm playing music in front of Saul. And then the next day I'm back to being a shepherd. And now you got me running over here to go." No, he just did his father's will. And so in verse 28, we see David. The final thing I want us to notice concerning David and how I see a comparison with Christ is that, I'll just say this concerning David and Christ in this, the will of his father not being one-dimensional. Think about Christ when he came to earth, all the things he had to endure and he had to suffer and put up with people and do all these different things on his way to the cross. When he came here, yes, he came here to shed his blood and to die and make himself a ransom for us. But there are so many other things that he did along the way that also were the will of the Father. But in verse 28, we see David criticized by his brethren and falsely accused of pride and trying to promote himself. Eliab, by this time, his older brother would have known, oldest brother, would have known that David was anointed. And here he comes, here comes David trying to promote himself. I'm sure Eliab knew that David had been anointed. And notice how he really treats David wrongly in light of that. It says in verse 28, "And Eliab, his eldest brother, heard when he spake unto the men. And Eliab's anger was kindled against David. And he said, Why camest thou down hither? And with whom hast thou left those few sheep in the wilderness?" Notice those few sheep. He's even demeaning what David did. "And with whom hast thou left those few sheep in the wilderness?" Eliab doesn't know, and he's criticizing. "You came down here, have you even left those sheep with anybody?" Yes, he did. And yes, David wasn't there on his own accord. But he didn't know. And then here's where Eliab falsely accuses him. "I know thy pride and the naughtiness of thine heart, for thou art come down that thou mightest see the battle." And so he was falsely accused. David was falsely accused by his own brethren. And we know that Christ was rejected of his own. And not just his nation, but at first, even his own brethren did not accept Jesus Christ for who he was. And so, the final thing, where was David born, or Jesus Christ born? Bethlehem, right? Where was David from? He was from Bethlehem. So, in verse 20, moving on, "And David rose up early in the morning and left the sheep with the keeper, and took and went as Jesse had commanded him, and came to the trench as the host was going forth to the fight, and shouted for the battle, for Israel and the Philistines had put the battle in array, army against army. And David left his carriage in the hand of the keeper of the carriage, and ran into the army and saluted his brethren." So we see once again in verse 22 that David delegates the responsibility that he had to deliver. He leaves. It says he left his carriage in the hand of the keeper of the carriage and ran into the army. And so we see, and I already read down through verse 29, so for the sake of time, we'll just get into the points. But we see how David viewed the nation of Israel as a special people chosen of God, and how he loved the Lord and loved the nation. In verse 26, he says, "What shall be done now to this man that killeth this Philistine and taketh away the reproach of Israel? For who is this uncircumcised Philistine that he should defy the armies of the living God?" Notice how he terms that. That he should defy the armies of the living God. This was not just vain nationalism. Patriotism, and I have a couple thoughts on this, but patriotism and nationalism should never stir our hearts as much as Christians in our day. It should never stir our hearts as much. Patriotism stirs my heart. Nationalism stirs my heart. But it doesn't stir my heart, and it shouldn't stir our heart as much as it does the advancement of the kingdom of God. And I believe something is spiritually wrong with us if we get more fired up and emotionally stirred over the national anthem than when we hear, "It is well with my soul, victory in Jesus, or amazing grace." My heart gets stirred up over the national anthem. But I think we kind of maybe have reached a dead spot when we feel more for our nation than we do for the advancement of the kingdom of God. Something is spiritually wrong with us if we can tolerate someone blaspheming the name of Christ, but take extreme exception when someone ridicules American exceptionalism. Right? Maybe someone's not on board with this America first thing. Make America great again. And boy, that just makes us mad. We just can't hardly stand that. But yet people can use Christ's name in vain, and yeah, it bothers us, but it doesn't bother us as much as, and it doesn't make our blood boil as much as it does the ignoramus who's against American exceptionalism. Something's wrong with us from a spiritual standpoint. Our perspective is skewed. David wasn't like that. I am very much patriotic and believe in defending our nation and values, but I can honestly tell you I am not as in love with America as I am with the church and the head of the church. I'm just not. There is the cause that he was referring to in verse 29 when he refers to his brother's false accusation. Verse 29 says, "And David said, what have I now done?" After he was falsely accused, he says, "What have I now done? Is there not a cause?" So for 40 days, this man has disrespected the nation and blasphemed God. And David was thinking, you know what? Perhaps God would have me do something about this. It's not too proudful when a child of God's heart is stirred and he has a burden or a desire, a burning desire to stand up and do something for the cause of Christ when it seems like everybody else is apathetic. You don't have to be afraid that, well, people are going to view this as me being too stuck on myself or thinking too highly of myself or being too... There's a time when it's okay. And David was a young man. And one of the reasons that his older brother was irritated is because he was the youngest brother. And Eliab was probably my 40, 45 by this point and had a family. I mean, there was, 8 brothers? So it's just natural that, you know, Eliab was 35 to 45. And here's this 17-year-old who comes up in here, has never been in a battle in his life as far as military. And he's talking about, is there not a cause? And in all this, who does he think he is? Listen, there's a certain point where just because the people of God that you're surrounded by are apathetic and dead doesn't mean that you should stay that way. And if you're the only one that feels like you need to stand up and take a stand or whatever the situation is, I can't give you an example, but don't be afraid to not be like David was here and say, is there not a cause? Is there not more to what we're supposed to be doing? Is there not more that we could be doing? And so perhaps God would have me do something about this. If nobody else will, then maybe I should. And so for David, it is not that he was any more able a soldier than anybody else to defeat Goliath. David didn't think, he didn't begin to think, you know what? The rest of these guys, they don't have it in them, but I think I got it in me to do it. No, he was just stirred because there was a cause. And he viewed his nation, he viewed what Goliath was doing as blaspheming against the armies of the living God. And his heart was stirred in him when no one else's was. When they were afraid, he believed that there's got to be a way. We can't just stand here and take this. And so he was more trusting of God, I believe, to provide the victory than anyone else. And that's all it really boiled down to. And so when that young person or a person comes along and his heart is stirred, is there not a cause? It's not so much about what you think you could do in and of yourself, but is there not a cause and can God not use me in some way? And so it's about us being used of God. And so he believed God had a purpose for him being there at that moment. He knew, I believe this because he turns to this person and they tell him, and then he goes, and after he got done with Eliab, look, it says in verse 30, and he turned from him, he turned from Eliab, to another, and spake after the same manner. And then the people answered him again after the former manner, about this is what's going on, this is what the reward will be. And Eliab heard him talking to people, and then David said, is there not a cause? And then what it shows is that, and David turned from his brother, he didn't stop, he wasn't deterred. And then he turned to someone else and said, is there not a cause? And he was fired up about this. And so he believed, I believe he began to believe that God had a purpose for him being there at that moment. And he knew there was more to leaving his father. He knew that there was more to all this than leaving his father to deliver food and get a report. And so we'll go ahead and pause there for the sake of time. There's absolutely no way we would ever get through this chapter. But anyway, this is a very enjoyable passage for me. There's so many things there as we look at the life of David as we continue, I pray that it'll be a blessing. And so just as a reminder, the next preaching service with Pastor Oldfield will begin at 11 a.m. sharp. Thank you.
I will refer to David